and welcome to Forever 35, a podcast about the things we do to take care of ourselves. I'm Kate Spencer.
And I'm Dori Shafrir.
And we're not experts.
But we are two friends who like to talk a lot about serums.
And hello and welcome.
Hello.
To yet another episode.
You just held Henry.
Oh my gosh. Talk about self-care. Holding someone else's child.
Yeah.
Real
he's
delicious.
Also like, he's at the age where he's like becoming a baby.
Yeah, he was looking around.
Yeah, he's got a big head.
He's got a nice big head. Oh, yeah. So, and his body just felt nice and heavy and comforting in my arms.
Yeah.
He was like a weighted blanket.
Oh,
a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Uh-huh. There is a weighted blanket vibe to holding a child.
Yeah, totally.
It felt great. So thank you for letting me have that.
You are so welcome. It's self-care.
I'm just going to break into his little bedroom anytime I come over and grab him.
You're going to come over when like I'm not home.
Yep. You'll walk in. I'll be sitting on the couch with your baby and your dog. That's when we know things have taken a turn.
For the better.
For the better. Your husband moves out.
Yeah.
We start our commune.
Into it.
Well, that went somewhere.
Yeah, it sure did. Anyway, how are you?
Dori. Last week I talked a lot about, or the past few weeks I've talked a lot about food struggles.
Yeah.
And people have been very kind and I've received a lot of kind messages. So I just want to say thanks for seeing me and hearing me.
We do see you, Kate.
Yes. And I really appreciate it. It's been an interesting challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just really in the beginning of it and I'm trying to look at myself with loving kindness. And practice that. But I really appreciate people have reached out with their own journeys and experiences and book recommendations.
Is there anything you've gleaned or learned from what you've heard from people?
I think the biggest thing for me is like, I am one of many.
Mm-hmm.
It is a large societal problem and I don't feel alone. And that's very comforting.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I did want to mention, since last week, I believe, my intention was to share my accomplishments.
Yes.
I finally finished a first draft of a fiction work.
Yay!
And that, for me, is an accomplishment.
That is a... For you?
I mean, for anyone,
that
sure.
That is huge, Kate.
I finished it, and I was like, look at me. I did it.
It's amazing.
I did it. So
you
that was very satisfying to have set out months ago to write this freaking thing. Ugh, Dori. God, what a slog. Anyway, I did it.
But you did it.
Did it, and I'm proud of myself.
And you wrote the end.
I kind of did. The last line is like, and so we went away. I was just so over it. I was like, I'll fix this down the road. I didn't know how to end it. So I just was like, the end, bye.
I can't wait to read it.
Well, one day when it's cleaned up a bit. But just the feeling of finishing something, I feel very proud of myself.
Yes, you should.
This could be a nothing burger of an item, but it doesn't matter
to
me.
But it's so satisfying.
Yeah, it is. It was very, I haven't had that experience often, and so it felt really good.
I'm so happy for
you.
Well,
thank you for your continued support.
Oh, you are welcome.
In the journey of writing. The only other thing that's been going on with me is that I've started lotioning up my boobs.
Mm.
Do you lotion your boobs?
Right now, I don't because they're the size of my head and...
All the more reason.
Very tender.
Yeah.
And I can like barely stand to touch them. I do try to lotion my stomach because I feel like especially since I gave birth, it's been especially dry, which is weird.
Interesting.
But yeah, I haven't really been lotioning my boobs. How's that been going for you?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, I put lotion on my body or oil after I shower sometimes. But I went and had a facial from our old friend Courtney Chisano.
Mm-hmm.
And she was showing me a product she had that was specifically a boob cream.
Oh.
She's like, and she was raving about it. And she said another thing that's really a great thing about the specific, like the intention behind this product by the person who makes it is for women to be touching their breasts every day. So you're also getting to know the feel of your breasts. If anything unusual pops up, you're more aware, you know, if there is a lump or tenderness or whatnot. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I should be creaming my boobs every day. So I didn't purchase the specific cream that she had, but I was like, you know, I have 8 million bottles of oil at my house. Let me start with those and just make sure to cream my boobs and my neck every day.
Yeah.
Get those boobs.
Feel
them, touch them.
How are they feeling?
Know them. They're good. Good. You know, they say hi.
Great.
They're doing great.
Hey, boobs.
Yeah, they're nice and moisturized right now. But it just, that was a good reminder. Like, I do try to do, you know, just check my breasts and my armpits for lumps and things. But why not do it more often?
Totally.
While getting moisturized in the process. So there you go.
There you go.
How have you been, my friend?
You know, I have been pretty good. I also felt very validated by our listeners.
What a group.
I mean, this is why we do this podcast, just to feel validated by the public.
Not gonna lie, Dory. It is a delightful bonus of making this podcast
to have
such a supportive group of listeners. Thank you.
But a couple weeks ago, I was talking about how I hadn't felt that kind of initial burst of love for my child, like when he came out, for various reasons, and that it had kind of been a slow burn. It came later. And I heard from a lot of people who had the same thing, and who also, a lot of people had felt guilt about that.
Yeah.
Because we do have we see these narratives of people being like, I was instantly in love, or, you know, I just felt the love wash over me, or whatever, like the first time they saw their child. And I think for a lot of us who that didn't happen, it wasn't like a thunderclap of love.
Great episode title, Dory.
Oh, thank you. That there's something wrong with us. You know,
or that you're a quote unquote bad parent.
Yeah. And there's just like a lot of stuff that we internalize and that we don't feel comfortable discussing, related to that. And I think, you know, it was really nice to hear from women who said, thank you for talking about this. So you're welcome. Thank you all for reaching out to me.
Yeah.
Because I also was like, am I weird?
Well, it's very vulnerable to be like, I didn't experience it the way we so often publicly hear people experience.
Yes.
Becoming a parent.
Yes.
My experience was different. And I think it's not that different. It's just the less talked about experience, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah. So thank you all for reaching out. Also, you know, I've been talking about vegetarianism.
We got so many nice kind,
yes,
compassionate responses about this.
It was very gratifying to hear from people about this. And for people to be like, yeah, it's cool for you to be kind of on a journey with this. Like, you don't have to be unequivocally vegetarian for the rest of your life now and never, you know, touch another piece of meat. That might happen, and that's okay. A lot of this is on a spectrum. But for the last few weeks, I've not been eating meat at all.
Cool.
And that's been, you know, it's interesting. Like, I've been exploring the world of meat substitutes.
What a world.
Like, you know, fake ground beef crumbles that I put in pasta sauce.
Which you found some brands that you like.
Yeah. There's Beyond Meat makes some good ones. What's the other brand? Gardenia or something?
That's what you said. Gardein? Is it like G-A-R-D?
Yeah, something like that.
We'll get the proper name right.
Yeah. And just, you know, there's like fake sausage, like stuff like that I've been using. But then also, I'm, you know, and because I'm not vegan, I've still been eating like eggs and stuff like that, and milk, but yeah, just kind of having a mostly plant-based diet. It's really interesting. It just, you know, you kind of have to reframe the way you approach food altogether.
It changes things, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
I remember when I first stopped eating meat, thinking about like the way I thought about what constitutes a meal change. Like, I feel like we'd always been like, meat.
Yes.
Starch. Vegetable. It doesn't, that's not
that's
what it
such
has
a good
to
point.
Be.
Yeah. I've been eating, you know, lentils and chickpeas and, you know, just a lot of avocado.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. So just sort of exploring that has been really, it's been kind of fun. You know, it's a little bit of a challenge. It's a puzzle in some ways.
And you like to explore. You're a curious person.
I'm a curious person. Yes, this is true. As are you.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention, I thought you might like this phrasing of things. So I was on the website minimalistbaker.com.
Oh, yes.
Are you familiar with that mm-hmm. website? So I believe the person who runs that is a former vegan and was vegan for many years. And the website was vegan recipes and then changed a bit. And I think this year announced they would start having some animal based recipes. But one thing on their website, this person says, it's this person, Dana, says Dana's food philosophy has evolved greatly over the last several years, and she now enjoys a diverse diet free from labels. And I loved that phrasing so much.
That's amazing.
Yes, I just loved that. A diverse diet free from labels.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I want to adopt that philosophy.
Yeah. That is really cool.
Yeah.
The other thing that I've been doing is I've been trying to like say yes to kind of mom and baby things.
It's like your own kind of year of yes via Shonda Rhimes.
Yeah, but you know, I
know you did that.
I did that. But yeah, I mean, I think making new friends as an adult is a challenge.
So hard.
And making new friends as a new mom is also kind of weird, and you're sort of thrown together with these other people just because you happen to have kids at the, you know, who were born at the same time. But I'm trying to like get out there more because I think it is good for my mental health.
Yeah.
Both to just like leave the house and to be able to talk to people who are at the same stage that I am. So I've been going to a Mommy and Me class, and yesterday I went on a picnic with some of the moms from the Mommy and Me class.
Fun.
Yeah, Henry wasn't in like the best mood, but it was fine, and it was like nice to get out and be outside and talk to other people, and so it was good.
It's hard though. Making friends is freaking hard.
But this is right, and like this is probably not something I would have done before, like go on a picnic with four other women who I don't really know.
Yeah, that's like a bold thing to do.
Yeah, and spend like 2 hours with them. So trying to, you know,
getting out of that comfort
stretch.
Zone a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Get out of the comfort zone.
Do you identify as an introvert?
I identify as an introverted extrovert.
I wonder what I am. Maybe an extroverted introvert? Doesn't matter. But you just identify as someone who you can communicate with people. You
yes.
enjoy being around people, but you also need
I need my
quiet.
Alone time.
Yeah.
And like after a couple hours with people, I'm like drained.
Yeah.
Like I came home and like I had a headache.
After the picnic.
Yes.
Yeah.
To like have to be on for that long around new people, I do find draining. But I love being around like my friends, you know, I like being around people, but also I find making like putting myself out there to be difficult. I've been trying to get better like over the last few years at small talk.
Oh.
Because it's really hard, but I do think it is like socially valuable.
I agree with both those statements. Yeah.
And I think actually, you know, there's a lot of like denigration of small talk.
And it is a way, it is the first step in getting to know somebody.
Exactly.
Like eventually it either stops there or it moves to the next level.
Exactly. Exactly. But you're not going to just like open a conversation with like, so how does your husband treat you? Or, you know what I mean? Like, you do talk about the weather, or in LA, like you talk about the traffic,
right.
or, you know,
what
these
are your top five insecurities and how are you handling
right,
them?
Exactly.
Yeah,
you don't open with that.
No.
So I don't know. These are just like interesting things that I think about now as I'm like meeting all these new people, and the small talk we have is generally around our babies.
Right, because you're brought together through a mom and me
yes.
situation. Yeah.
And it's like, it's usually like, how are they sleeping?
I know. And I find that when I would go hang out with other new moms, I would leave and be like, I don't know anything. Like, I don't really know. We don't know each other. We're just talking about these, like, these beings that we
totally.
Have. And it's and getting past that is hard.
We did finally, I feel like towards the end of the picnic, we all started, we talked a little bit about like what we do for a living. And when I brought up the podcast, they asked me for some skincare recommendations.
Ooh, and you were like, yeah. Here I go.
I was like, hyaluronic acid.
Gather around, everyone.
Exactly. And then the other thing is, Kate, I took your advice.
Go on.
I bought pants.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about where, what, how.
So, you know, I know we talk a lot about trying to avoid fast fashion and sustainable clothing, but I had neither the time nor the money to buy sustainable or secondhand stuff at the moment. I just had to march into Old Navy.
Yes.
And get it done.
And did you get it done?
I did. You know, some people had recommended their Rockstar jeggings. I didn't love them, but I found they had some nice linen pants.
Is that what you're wearing right now?
No, okay. These are actually maternity pants.
Oh, okay.
They had some linen pants, and then they had some like twill pants that were very soft. Mm. I'll show them to you. And I'm very happy with them. And then
great.
I ordered a couple more pairs from the website. So, you know, I needed to be clothed.
Yes. And clothes that fit your body where yeah. it is right now.
Exactly. And then I did find a pair of jeans at Madewell that I bought that I really liked. It's weird. My body, I feel like my body right now is just like shaped differently.
Totally. And it might, it's going to assume a new shape, perhaps.
Yeah.
It might not, we're never going to return to who we were yesterday.
No, it's true.
We keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Embrace the shape.
So thank you for that suggestion.
Anytime.
And, I can actually clothe myself.
I'm very happy for you. That's such
thank
a
you.
Good feeling.
It is a
I
good
think.
Feeling. Yeah, for sure. Well, should we take a short break?
Let's take a pause and we can come back with our guests.
Okay. I like to care for my skin, duh. And it's also something that I do love to kind of like get into the research on.
You do have a curious mind.
Look, I have a curious mind. I can't help it.
You do.
But today's sponsor, OneSkin, has made that easy because they do their own fantastic research for their products. In fact, their products are scientifically validated to improve your skin's health while targeting the root cause of aging. The secret is OneSkin's proprietary OS1 peptide. It's the first ingredient proven to switch off the aging cells that cause lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin, and they've got several studies to back it up. They also have an amazing new sunscreen.
Ooh, our favorite.
Our fave, it's the OS1 Shield Protect and Repair SPF 30+. It's got the peptide. It's a mineral sunscreen. It's got antioxidants. It comes in tinted and untinted. I mean, like, what can't this thing do? I'm just saying. I love it. It's so easy to use, and I love that it's just like zoop, and it feels so nice going on. But don't take my word for it. OneSkin has over 4,000 five-star reviews and was recently recognized by Fast Company as one of the most innovative brands of 2024. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on the cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using code FOREVER at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code FOREVER. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them, and please support your show and tell them we sent you.
Y'all, I was in head to toe quince the other day, and I have never felt better. This is not an exaggeration. I loved my entire outfit, and it was literally everything was from Quince.
Wow. Did you deliberately go head to toe Quince, or just was like, oh, I want to wear this. I want to wear this. And then you were like, oh, I'm in head to toe Quince.
All right. Let me tell you what happened. Okay. So okay. I knew I wanted to put on, I have these pants from Quince that I'm obsessed with. They're called the French Terry Modal wide leg pant. They're so comfortable and they look really stylish. So they like feel like you're wearing a comfy sweat, but they're like a gorgeous flowy pant. And my child complimented them. It was wild.
Wow.
And okay. Then I was like, you know what? It's warm out, but it's also kind of chilly. What could I wear? And I have a zip up cashmere hoodie from Quince. And I was like, well, I'll put this on. And then I was like, LOL, I'm in all Quince. I might as well just put on this Quince white t-shirt that I have. Because I wanted a white t-shirt. Like it just, so the t-shirt, I was like, you know, I was kind of like, tee hee, only I know I'm in head to toe Quince. But I share this to share like, one, how much I just love their pieces and how much use I get out of them, because I like to be comfortable, but I also want to look like slightly put together. And I just feel like either individually or on their own, all my items from Quince just work.
Okay. I love that for you.
They travel beautifully. I have a really beautiful linen dress from Quince that travels really well. They have washable silk tops, 14 karat jewelry. And the best part, you know, with Quince is that all items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner directly with top factories, which means Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and they pass those savings on to us. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Quince.
They also only work with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I really love that. I love my products from Quince. And you know what? Dare I say, I looked good. So whether you want to be cozy or get warm weather ready, do it with Quince. Go to quince.com/forever35 for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/forever35 to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/forever35. Our guest today is Elizabeth Gilbert, and we're so excited she is here with us. Elizabeth is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Big Magic and Eat, Pray, Love, as well as several other internationally bestselling books. She has been a finalist for the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Penn Hemingway Award, and her novel, The Signature of All Things, was named a best book of 2013 by the New York Times, Oprah Magazine, The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune, and The New Yorker, and her new book, City of Girls, is out now, which Kirk has called a big old banana split of a book, surely the cure for what ails you, which as someone who is in the middle of reading it right now, I can say that it is. It's like the most delicious, soothing, yummy thing to just like dig into and devour. I'm just loving it.
Wow. Thank you. I'm sorry to have laughed so openly, but I still get a kick out of a big old banana split of a book. That's perfect.
It's the best quote. I've never, ever read about a book being compared to a banana split, but I find it very accurate. And also it kind of nails a lot of the time when the book takes place. So it just felt very perfect. So Liz, we have started a lot of our interviews by asking our interviewees about a self-care practice that they have. And it doesn't need to be some sort of like big triumphant thing, but we're more curious about something you might do on a regular basis to help take care of yourself, to make yourself feel good or grounded or in your own skin.
I will tell you one that I do that is relatively new. I mean, there's all the sort of fancy official self-care practices that I've gone in and out of over the years, like all of us go in and out of them. You know, like sometimes we do yoga and sometimes we're running for a while and sometimes we have a meditation practice. If you're like me, you've probably done all of those things at varying degrees of discipline. but for me, the one that lately has been a real game changer is that I dance every day. And this started about a year and a half ago after my partner, Rhea Elias, passed away. And it became one of the things that I do every day to kind of let grief, it started as sort of letting grief move through my body through physical movement. And now it's just become a way that I wake up and that I, kind of embrace the day. And I just put my own music on my phone and I hit shuffle and I will dance to whatever comes up, which means that sometimes it's like AC/DC and sometimes it's Leonard Cohen and sometimes it's Mozart, whatever is there. And it's just been the most extraordinary transformative practice. I also think it's also really important for us to remember that we have a body. If you're like me, your very first thing of the day is to, as soon as you achieve consciousness from being asleep, you're instantly in your head. And the debates begin, the arguments begin, the shame begins, the terror begins, the anxiety begins, you know, and you're just, oh, the head's awake. So now it's running the show. And I think it's really nice to, for me, it's been really nice to remember that I'm not just a head on a broomstick. I actually have a human body.
You have limbs.
Yeah, I have limbs and it just moves energy around in a different way. And it's great. I love it. I am no kind of dancer. This is nothing that anybody, needs to see. And I can tell you truly that if I can dance, anybody can. But it does something to you and it's just really great.
Has it been, useful in just kind of experiencing the way grief manifests physically? I wrote a whole book about grief and loss. I lost my mom also to pancreatic cancer.
I know
it physically lived in my body, and I'm wondering if it's a way of just kind of getting it out or getting it moving or just feeling it more.
All of those things. And, you know, as you know, because you've been through it, and as probably most people know, because everyone will at some point go through it, grief can feel like anything from you're on fire with a searing, blistering emotional pain to you have a flu that just won't go away. You know, and it never, you know, just heaviness, there's a weight. I mean, I'm struck by my own grief experience about how much vitality it takes out of you, even though there are times where it's very electrifying. I mean, in the kind of heightened moments of grief, the great moments of sobbing and feeling the keening of that loss, that's a kind of vitality. But the rest of it, after those moments, it seems to kind of settle on you like a weight. That's how I experience it. It's very heavy. You just don't feel good. You just don't feel right. And everything is hard, and walking up a flight of stairs is hard, and getting out of bed is hard. Everything, it's like gravity has changed. And so, yeah, I feel like dancing is a way of allowing the heaviness out. And I not so much now, but in the early months of my grief, I would cry almost every time I danced. It was just a way of just getting it out of my bones and into the atmosphere and letting a friendly, neutral air that surrounds us absorb it so that it doesn't have to live inside of you.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I want to do that.
I know.
I'm not really grieving right now, but.
But you don't, I don't think you need to be.
I'm not either so much. I mean, it comes and goes, but it's like, it's still really, it's become a practice that I can't imagine ever starting a day without dancing again.
There's something so powerful too about just being in your body,
mm-hmm.
and that the privilege of having our bodies and being able to move them is so beautiful, and then enjoying some music and you don't know what's going to pop up. Did you dance today?
I did dance today. I danced today to some Motown, which was a really, it's also such a nice surprise because I also feel it's kind of like a randomness of, let's turn this over to the universe and see what needs to be felt right now. So when it's Al Green, you know, it's like, oh, I guess I need to feel that. Like there's a very particular thing that feels like, you know, and then other times it's Pharrell and you're like, oh, I guess I need to feel this, you know, and other times it's Jeff Buckley and the tears are sheeting down my face and I'm like, oh, I guess I need to feel this. And this is one of the things that music can do. And it's so unintellectual. That's what I like about it. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's not even the strictness of meditation. It's giving yourself over to something. And it's never the wrong song. Mm.
Well, I know what I'll be doing tomorrow when I wake up.
please join me for dance to a random song and see what it feels like exercise.
I did, you know, I did that actually recently, and it was the most amazing feeling. And that feeling of also not care, not one, nobody's watching, but also not giving a crap what it looks like is so empowering.
It's amazing. And it also brings me back to a moment that I'll never forget. At the very early onslaught of Rhea's diagnosis, where we had been doing a lot of crying and a lot of upheaval, and we were in California, we were visiting a friend, and it had been a day of just the grieving that is also interwoven into being with somebody at the beginning of a terminal diagnosis, which is a very particular kind of emotional state to be in. And, you know, we were all just so bowed down by it. And all of a sudden, a David Bowie song came on, and Rhea just got this giant smile on her face. And she was like, well, you guys, we could either just sit here at this picnic table and keep crying, or we can dance. And she just stood up and started dancing, and we did too. And I'll never forget what she looked like in that moment. And I think that's part of what compelled me to begin to do it was, well, Liz, you can sit on this couch and keep crying, which is also okay. Or we can get up and dance and remember that as per this moment, you actually still have life. She wasn't even in any pain at that point. Mm. She'd found out about her cancer in a very roundabout, accidental way. So she was like, well, I guess now we're going to just do this. And so that's part of me honoring that whole spirit.
Mm. To kind of stay on this topic of grief, but switch gears a little bit to writing. You have said that you wrote City of Girls while you were grieving, and that it's the lightest, funniest thing I've written out of the darkest grief. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that, kind of how that happened and, you know, what it's like to write a book when you are truly grieving.
Well, I just got this flash in my head when you said, how did it happen? I have to just say grace. It happened because of grace. It's not something that I would have planned. It's not something that I would have been smart enough to figure out on my own. Mm. What happened is that the book was due. The book was due, really. That's it. And it was due August 1st, and Rhea died on January 4th of that same year. And I hadn't worked on it for 18 months. I had worked on it and done a lot of research on it prior to her getting ill. And then as soon as she got sick, you know, a plug was pulled on my entire life. Whatever metaphor you want to use, a trap door opened. I fell through it. Nothing else in the world mattered to me. I couldn't begin to imagine even caring about something as frivolous as a novel about New York City showgirls in the 1940s and their sexual escapades. Who cares? Who cares about musical theater? Who cares about costuming and fashion? Who cares about who could even begin to care? And the entire time that Rhea was sick and dying, I was writing constantly, but I was writing about her, because I wanted to chronicle every single moment of it and not lose it. But this book was actually the one I was contracted to deliver to my publisher on August 1st, and they'd already given me a year extension because of her illness. And I got the sense, in a few conversations with them, that they would not be particularly open to offering another extension. They were kind of like, no, this is really, really, really due. And part of me wanted to play the pity card, which would have been very valid, to just say, you've got to be kidding me. Like, you can't possibly expect me to deliver this. Look what I've just gone through. But there was this tiny little response that I had when I started getting the signal from them saying this book is really due, that was the beginning of the feeling of a return of vitality. And what it was a sense of, oh, holy shit, I don't know if I can do this. Like, oh, this would be an interesting challenge. Like, who can, and that feeling, instead of feeling overwhelming in terms of I'm over my head, I can't do this, felt like a dare. It felt like a dare. And there's enough of me that responds to dares to take the dare and to just say, like, what do you think, Gilbert? What do you got? Can you pull out of you what you promised? A book that you said was going to go down like a champagne cocktail, like a tray of champagne cocktails. Can you find that from this place? And that, and I was like, God, I don't know. And I'm, I'm at a point in my life creatively where I've been doing this work. I've been writing my entire life. I've been doing this professionally for 30 years, and I pretty much know that I know how to do it. But that sense of doubt of, I don't know if I can do that under these circumstances, was actually exactly what I needed to give myself a challenge. And it was scary because I thought, I don't have my vitality. I don't have any interest in this. I don't feel my creativity flowing through me, but I'm going to see if I can pull this off as a dare, literally as a dare. And then once I started writing, I realized that I'd forgotten this amazing thing about creativity, which is that a lot of times we don't engage in creativity because we don't feel like we have any vitality, but actually creativity is the thing that restores vitality. And so that's how you get it. You don't wait till you feel good to create. You create, and then you will start to feel good. And lo, it came to pass again, even in those extraordinary circumstances.
I mean, come on. Your wisdom is just... I'm sitting here, I'm holding Dory's copy of Big Magic because we've both read it as writers and it's resonated with us both so much. We get a lot of listeners of the podcast who write in.
Well, and we should just say what Big Magic is.
Oh, excuse me, Dory. Yes, go ahead.
It is her book about creative living beyond fear. And it was really important for me when I wrote my book.
Same.
Yeah. So thank you
for
writing
it. Help. Yeah. That is the one book I've ever written that I can honestly say I only had one motive in writing that book, and it was actually that I really wanted to help people. That, you know, Eat, Pray, Love, which turned into like a big self-help book, was actually literally a self-help book, and that I wrote it to help myself.
Yeah.
And you know, and it ended up helping other people. But Big Magic, really, I did feel like, oh, I want to help people. I want to help people get on the other side of their fear with creativity, because there is so much to be found on the other side of it if you can give yourself over to it. So I'm so delighted to hear that it was helpful to you.
What do you say when people are like, I'm scared, or I feel like it's already been done. I don't know what I would do. You know, I love the word vitality is such an interesting word to bring into the conversation. I'm curious what you say to people when they express their, you know, they read your book and they still express their fear or their self-doubt about their own creativity.
You know, I think what I would most want to do is just normalize that as much as possible. Because I think in some ways, I'm just spitballing this as I'm talking to you, but in some ways, it's not so much the fear that's the problem. It's the terrible, terrible shame around the fear that's the problem. The idea that there's something particularly wrong with you, that you are particularly cowardly, that you are particularly unambitious, that you are particularly undisciplined. And I would instantly want to just be like, oh, honey, me too. Like, I'm scared every time I begin a project. And that's, and the relationship that I've established over the years is not so much a posture of fearlessness. It's a posture of empathy toward myself about my fear. And so what I would invite the person to do is to, see if they can alter their posture toward their fear from one of, like shame and recoiling, which actually only shuts you down more, to a very loving, like maternal. And by maternal, I don't mean in the example of the actual mother that you may have had. I mean, in the example of like the great mother, the great loving mother. And allow your fear, and really good exercise is to allow your fear to write you a letter and tell you everything that it's afraid of without you interrupting it, without you arguing with it, without you shaming it, without you saying why you like this, why can't you be better, why, you know, it's not a conversation, it's you listening. Mm. So you just imagine that it's like the truth and reconciliation hearing, or you know, imagine if you, I know this will be hard for some of you to imagine if you came from a really dysfunctional family. Wow. Imagine that. And imagine if one member of the family actually achieved enlightenment and was able to say, look, I'm putting down all the weapons of war, and I'm just going to sit here at this kitchen table, at this wooden kitchen table, very wearily, but open, with a cup of coffee in my hand and a single light bulb burning overhead. And I'm going to invite anybody who wants to speak to come in. Who's first? Oh, hi, fear. Come on in. And then fear gets to come and sit there and write its letter and say, this is what I'm so scared of. And you just listen. You just listen. And you'll be amazed at how much that can change in your life. One thing that will happen is that you may discover that a lot of us think that our fear is bottomless and infinite. But if you actually let it speak without interrupting it, you'll discover that it will come to an end. There's actually you'll actually have trouble keeping that letter going for more than 5 or 6 minutes. once it lists, it'll run out of things. And I think we just don't think that fear ever has an end. But if you don't interrupt it, it will come to an end. And you'll also see that the things that it's afraid of might actually be pretty reasonable. And that there'll be maybe 6 or 7 of them. And that's what it is. I'm afraid of not having any money. I'm afraid of not being good enough. I'm afraid of being criticized. These are all reasonable things to be afraid of, you know? And if you can then say that to your fear in a very loving way, write a letter back to it and say, I hear you and I see you and I see how scared you are. And it's totally understandable. Who wants to be criticized? Who wants to fail? Who wants to run out of money? Who wants to feel like they don't have any talent? Just let, you know, just be understanding and then say, I'm really glad you got a chance to talk. And now we're going to begin making something because I'm just 1% more curious about the outcome of this than I am afraid of it. And just let that curiosity be the thing that takes you to the next step.
I have a book due in December and I think I need to reread Big Magic.
Yeah. And write that letter to
yes,
fear, Dory.
I do.
Yeah. You mentioned shame, and there's a quote that is in City of Girls that I love, and I'm don't think I'm the first person to point this out, but you write that at some point in a woman's life, she just gets tired of being ashamed all the time, and after that, she is free to become whoever she truly is. Mm. And that's like a
preach.
Just an arrow to the heart. And so much of what you're talking about is just the kind of exploration of sexuality and things that make us feel good. And so often shame is tied up in a lot of those things. And I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit to that and how we can find, you know, joy and freedom in our desires as women.
Well, it's tricky. I mean, you're up against a lot. You're up against centuries of a training that tells you that there's something inherently bad and wrong about you. And that can show up in all sorts of ways. You know, it's prevalent throughout the entire culture. I mean, I would say that the central lie upon which Western culture is based is there's something wrong with you. You know, that is the central lie. And it's a very difficult lie to unthread, because it's in the groundwater, you know, it's in our bones. We've been drinking that lie down our whole lives and everything in the culture will tell you that, you don't even have to come from a particularly religious culture to have inherited that idea. You can get it just from the media and from depictions of what a woman is supposed to look like, be like, feel like, act like, and you can get it. It's not exclusive to Christian conservatives. You can also be you can also be very shamed from the left, from progressives who say that it's, you know, that your desire to dress up and be sexual and to show your body is demeaning to women. You know, that so, like, it doesn't matter which way you turn, you're going to get it. Like, yeah. Somebody's going to tell you that you're doing it wrong, and somebody's going to tell you that. Sorry about the siren. We're getting too close to the truth.
They're coming for us.
Yeah.
Oh God.
A bunch of black helicopters up there too. So to me, the beginning of it is, you know, and I sound like I know I'm banging a drum on this because it's going to sound very similar to what I said about creativity, but I think it's of the essence for all of us is establishing a loving sense of stewardship towards your own self in all her forms. And this is the one thing that it's taken me forever to learn and that I have to keep learning again and again is that I don't really know how, I don't at all know how the universe works. I don't know what my purpose is here. I don't know who I'm supposed to belong to. I don't know how any of this works, but one thing that I've been able to glean is that apparently I was given this one. I'm pointing to myself right now. I was given this one to take care of, like something, whether it was random or whether it was intentional, put in my hands this being, and said, well, this is yours to take care of. I don't know who else I'm supposed to be taking care of, but I know at this point in my life that loving stewardship toward myself is the highest possible way that I can honor the responsibility that I was given to take care of her, to take care of her health and her heart and her mind. And so that's the beginning of it, you know, and that's the beginning of saying something that I used to hear Rhea say all the time, which was, I've got me. Mm. I've got me. Like, everyone else can leave. Everyone else can disappoint me. Everyone else can fail me. And everyone else can be in their own drama and not be able to look out for me in the ways that I want. But bottom line is, you know, and she only was able to start saying that in her mid-50s when she had finally reached that point where she was like, I've got me, you know, and that's not saying that you're in control of everything. It's just saying that your fundamental posture toward yourself is one of loving care. And that means to me that you try stuff and it may or may not work. You know, having that sense of I've got me doesn't mean that any of this is perfectible. It doesn't mean that sex is ever going to be safe. That's something that I think is really interesting to watch in this culture, is how we keep trying to break the code on figuring out how to have sex and intimacy be safe, when in fact, my experience has never been that it ever is. There's a lot of vulnerability in it. There's a lot of desire in it. There's a lot of possibility for people to get hurt, to hurt or to hurt others. There's a lot of certainty that then dissolves and becomes uncertainty. There's a lot of ambivalence. It's messy. It is the ultimate collision of two energies, two very messy energies. So I don't know that the answer is, let's figure out how to do this in such a way that we do it right. I think the answer is, let's try to do things. And then if it turns out that it was a dumpster fire rather than the beautiful romance that we were imagining, I've got me. There will be a net that catches me, and it will be me. It will be me saying, okay, sweetheart, you did your very best on that. That hurt. That went all wrong. I'm really sorry. Past me thought that it was a really great idea with the evidence that she had. Turns out not so much. How are we going to take care of you now from here? Like, what is the best amount? What is it that you need today to start to recover yourself again? How are we going to give our heart back to ourselves now? How can I love you today? How can I take care of you today? That's stewardship. And I think that's the only thing that really can be not controlled, but tended to. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I listened to your most recent Super Soul Sunday. I love a good Super Soul Sunday, but then when I saw it was like, oh, you know, double whammy. And you talked so much about having mercy for yourself, which I thought was so interesting. That word doesn't come up as much as I think it should. And I loved just hearing you use it in as like the first step of self-love.
This is a merciless, merciless culture. Absolutely merciless. You know, who do you know? Who do you see out there in the world modeling? You may see people out there modeling what it's like to be merciful toward others in a way that may sometimes actually turn into martyrdom, even, you know, giving of themselves until there's nothing left, until they're completely depleted. And that's held up as a model of self-sacrifice. But where do you see, who do you see setting the tone of what it looks like to stand facing towards yourself in a genuine posture of mercy? It's, where is that? You know, we talk about self-acceptance, but self-acceptance is so grudging. You know, it's like, all right, I accept you. And we talk about self-love, and self-love is so lofty. It's like, God, that seems out of reach, you know? I just feel like the word that always melts my pain is mercy. I'm just going to try to find mercy toward myself right now, toward the dilemma, the central dilemma of being a human being, the particular dilemma of being female, my own shortcomings of character that cause me to run into the same sorts of problems again and again, the stuff that I can't seem to get right, no matter how old I get, my ego, my vanity, my desperation, my neediness, all of that needs to be addressed. But before it can be quote unquote fixed, it has to be held in a compassionate state of mercy. And I feel like the easiest way to do that is to ask yourself whether you think you are so very special that you alone are not deserving of mercy. Because I mean, I can hear it in your voices and the way that you speak and the podcast that you've created for women. Clearly, I don't have to go out of my way to guess that you guys are probably two people who really care about moving through the world in a state of compassion, and that's what you want to be. You want to be compassionate and you want to be loving. And I can also probably guess that you leave yourselves out of that equation all the time because everybody does.
Oh, you're so correct.
And it doesn't take a genius to figure that out. I don't have to read your tarot cards to know that about you because you're just like me. And so what I would tell you is that it's a very lovely and lofty aim to want to practice universal human compassion, but universal human compassion that does not include the self is actually not universal, nor is it compassionate. And that's where the rubber meets the road right there is, can you actually fold yourself into that as well? And where I really started to get this lesson is when I realized that there's a tremendous narcissism in excluding yourself from the mercy that you would show to anybody. So if anyone came up to you and told their story, and it was exactly like your story, the same thing that you're ashamed of, and they came and they told it to you, and they were like, I can never forgive myself for this. I can never stop beating myself up for this. Like, of course you would like enfold them in total mercy and be like, oh my God, you've got to let this go. I would like, you would never want to let another human being suffer in that, but you won't release yourself. And so to me, what I realized is that's profoundly narcissistic because what you're saying is I'm a special case. I'm actually to be held to a higher standard of ethics and morals than anyone else. Everybody else gets to be forgiven, not me. What makes you so special that you also do not get to be enfolded in the family of man and human mercy? And that's the beginning of actually the humility that's at the basis of real mercy. So the it's a practice of humility to say that I'm just one of us. I'm just one of us. I'm just another sick and suffering person trying to manage the dilemma of being consciousness in an ape's body. I don't know what the hell is going on. I'm not in control always of my desires. I have an ungovernable mind. I'm doing my very best, and sometimes I'm doing my very worst. And I too am a child of this mystery deserving of mercy. That's the ultimate practice of humility.
I believe you're turning 50 this year. Is that correct?
Yeah. Like in minutes.
Are you a July birthday or
I'm
June?
A July birthday. Yeah.
What does that look like for you? You know, our podcast is called Forever 35. We're both in our 40s. You know, we love talking. We have listeners who are in college, but we also have listeners who are in their 50s and 60s. And I'm just curious where... How do you celebrate another rotation on the earth? What does that mean to you?
I'm so excited. I'm really, really excited about being 50. I've actually been laying claim to it for 2 years, even though I'm not, just because I think I love the gravitas that it gives me.
It's beautiful, you know, number.
Like, I'm 50 now, so I'm allowed to, the only birthday that really jacked me was 30. 30 was really hard because I had ended up in such a wrong place for my integrity. I was in a marriage that I wasn't happy in, and I was supposed to start trying to have a kid, and I was just following what had happened is that I had followed the template of what culture tells you will make you happy. And so I had gotten married and I was like, okay, that's done. That's a question is settled. And then when I'm 30, I'll have a kid. And I just couldn't do it. So I had a major, major nervous breakdown, meltdown, went into a two or three year long, very terrible depression. Like I really lost myself, but it was on my way to finding myself. Mm. So I think all the big birthdays now feel really great because I'm like, oh, I'm not there.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I got out. I saved myself. For me, 50 is a celebration of all the times and all the ways that I keep saving my own life. Cause I do tend to accidentally keep ending up in circumstances innocently thinking this is where my happiness is going to be, and then finding out again and again and again that it's not, and then using my heart and my courage to get me out of it and back to something that feels good again. And so that's what I feel like the greatest thing is about 50 is like, I have saved my life so many times. Like Liz and I have gotten through so much stuff together. I have like boosted myself out of so many jail cells. I've gotten myself out of so many situations that where it's like, ooh, I thought this would bring me, I thought this was a parachute, but it's actually a backpack filled with bricks. Like, oh no, you know, like, oh, I thought this was, you know, I took the blue pill instead of the pink pill. And yet here we are, you know, so there's this great sense of joy of, oh my God, we've gotten through the whole maze so far and we're still here. It's so good.
Well, we're so glad you're here. And we're so...
Thanks. I'm glad I am too.
We're really glad to get to talk to you. It's been such a joy.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for your big hearts and your smart minds. It's been lovely talking to you.
So you already, on this podcast, fulfilled one of your intentions from last week.
I executed my intention to share and celebrate my accomplishments, feel pride, and when I do a good job or when I get something done. I also sent a note to my writing group and sent a note to another writing group. And I was like, I did it. I finished the manuscript. I'm proud. Yeah. So I did it.
I'm proud of you.
Well, thank you.
What about next week?
Next week, Dory, I'm getting back to my gratitude practice. I'm participating in it every day.
Yay.
I'm committing to doing that. And I'm going to do my gratitude practice daily for the month of July. July is my birthday month. It's kind of something I like to do. If anyone wants to join me in the month of July,
that's
we can do
so
a little
cool
grat challenge together.
That's very cool.
So every day, daily, getting it back in gear.
Into it.
Thank you. Last week, you were looking for a way to get back into the physical space.
I love that framing.
Well, thank you.
I went to the gym.
That's right. I texted you.
Yeah.
And you were like, I just finished at the gym.
Yeah. So I went once.
Perfect.
I walked on the treadmill.
Amazing.
For about half an hour. And then I did some stretching. Mm. And I took a shower and left.
A perfect session.
Yeah. So... again, it was like one of those things where I felt like it didn't even matter what I did there. I could have walked on the treadmill for 30 seconds.
You could have just showered.
I could have just showered. It was the act of getting out of the house, going to the gym, just sort of like committing to that for myself. That was important. So I did it. And I think now that the seal has been broken, I'm already thinking about when can I get back? How can I fit that into my day?
Great job, Dory.
Thank you.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
What are you headed for this week coming up?
Well, I want to get back on that old cooking and meal planning train.
Okay.
I'm ready for it.
Cool.
Yeah. I've been cooking a little more, just trying to get takeout less, which, you know, is hard.
Yes. Takeout is so easy.
Takeout is so easy.
So expensive.
So expensive. And so, you know, just kind of trying to watch that. But also just health wise, takeout is often very salty, very heavy. Like I don't always feel so great after I eat it. And so, that's also partly why I want to get back into meal planning. So I'm excited about that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see what vegetarian recipes you come up with this week.
I know.
Well, Dory.
That brings us to the end.
Friends, if you want to leave us a voicemail, the number is 781-591-0390, or you can always email us at forever35podcast@gmail.com.
Our Facebook group is facebook.com/group/forever35podcast, and the password is serums.
And if you enjoy the show, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, tell a friend, or mention us on ye olde social media.
And just a reminder that everything we mention is always on our website, forever35podcast.com. And you can follow us on Instagram at forever35podcast and on Twitter at forever35pod.
And of course, Forever 35 is hosted and produced by Dory Shafrir and Kate Spencer and produced and edited by Sammy Junio. Lane Hammer is our assistant.
Bye, y'all.
Thank you.